Welcome to the first ever episode of the Mazeltov Cocktail Podcast with your host Max Kaiser, a Jewish left podcast from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, Melbourne. This podcast is a little bit of an experiment, so bear with me as I find my feet. At the moment, my focus will be on conversations with people in Australia and internationally on history and politics from a lefty perspective. We'll have Jewish content and some not-so-Jewish content. If you have ideas for the show or just want to get in touch, email mazeltovcocktailpodcast@gmail.com. For this first episode, we have a conversation between myself and my good friend Allegra Rinalda about Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism, which we've been reading together for the past few months. We talk Trump, hashtag fake news, anti-politics, Podemos, and populism. Stay tuned to hear Allegra take on Noam Chomsky and call me a conspiracy theorist. I'll be back after the interview to do some shout-outs. All right, so Allegra, you're gonna talk to us today about The Origins of Totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt. This book has become like a bestseller of our times. One thing I saw said that sales had increased by 16 times. Another thing I saw was that Amazon had sold out of The Origins of Totalitarianism. And then there's sort of like seems like there's an endless stream of think pieces that are coming out saying, you know, Hannah Arendt tells us exactly what's, you know, Trumpism and sort of new right-wing populism means. What's your take on this phenomenon? Why are people turning to Arendt in such a big way?
Yeah, it's funny to note that a kind of monolith of contemporary capitalism, Amazon, becomes our market for what's happening in critical theory. But it's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. I've read the same fact time and time again about that, about Amazon having sold out. I'm thrilled. I think it's great. People are reading Arendt. And I think that Origins of Totalitarianism has a lot to contribute to the understanding of present times, not necessarily because we're in a pre-totalitarian phase, but certainly because what Arendt would think of as our common world, our condition of worldliness, is being imperiled. And there are a number of things that like really jump out at one in terms of her description in the origins and contemporary conjecture. One is the distinction between lies and truth and fact and opinion, and that's the four different modes of communication which need to be looked at very carefully. Another one is the conspiratorial view of the understanding of the world, a conspiratorial worldview, which seeks to find hidden motifs and movements beneath factual reality. Another thesis, which is not actually written about in Origins of Totalitarianism, but in another book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, is the banality of evil thesis, which describes the way in which evil in the modern world is not necessarily radical evil in terms of a kind of giving oneself an evil maxim, but a kind of bureaucratically diffused, more insidious form of evil in which non-evil people can do incredibly evil things. And the last thing that really jumps out at me, and is perhaps hasn't really been covered so well yet, but I think is interesting, is Arendt was a remarkably unsympathetic thinker, and so and I'll explain this more later, but she didn't think that empathy or compassion were the answer to great injustice or woes in the world. So this kind of gives us an idea of how we might orient ourselves as critical people in dark times.
That's great. All right. Well, there's a lot in there to unpack, but we kind of agree in this way that one of the things that's interesting about the origins of totalitarianism is not that you can sort of say, all right, this is what totalitarian movements look like before, according to Arendt. This is how Trump aligns with them, you know, in this way, this way, and this way. What it actually does, and this, we've been reading the first two sections primarily on anti-Semitism and then on imperialism, and they're really about describing, as you say, sort of the loss of a common political world and sort of the rise of what we would now call anti-politics. So a complete sort of lack of faith in political institutions, politicians, that, yeah, as you say, precisely leads to these different ways of thinking about and engaging in the world that that you mentioned before. But can you tell us a little bit about, yeah, what does Arendt mean by this common world? What sort of political situation or sort of depolitical situation or unraveling political situation was she describing over the course of events leading up to 20th century totalitarianism?
Well, the idea of a common political space or public sphere was so central to Arendt's thought. I mean, it's the kind of motif around which everything else unfolds, and her commitment to that space is incredible. And you used the term before, I think something like a kind of loss of faith in political institutions. And that's certainly one aspect. Institutions are one aspect of that common world. And Arendt is thought of, and rightly so, as a very radical thinker, and she is. She's a thinker in the revolutionary tradition. She's also a conservative thinker in a certain way, and in a great way, and that's that she places great emphasis on institutions as founding that common space, as keeping that common space together. You know, in order to have a world and not just, you know, not just a natural world, but a human world, which we have in common, to be able to see the same things and talk about the same things, we need to have institutions, political institutions. That's only one part of it. The other part of it is not so conservative. It's about the imminence of the political space itself. So Arendt put great stock on action and speech, and speech is a form of action. In this shared space, and that's what keeps it alive. I mean, you can have as many fantastic, you know, constitutionally tight institutions as you want, but if you don't have people speaking and acting within that common space, you don't have anything. I mean, this is also a kind of critique that sometimes has been leveled against, you know, impartial or kind of technocratic liberalism, that once that kind of activity in the public sphere dissipates, well, all you've got is a bunch of technocrats sustaining these quite meaningless institutions. So, yeah, to sum up, I would say that action and institutionality are the two sides of that world in common, and that world in common is kind of the central motif of Arendt's thought.
So, yeah, what is that analogy that we can draw then? Rather than, yeah, simply saying, well, we're in a pre-totalitarian moment, or, you know, Trumpism is Nazism, what can we say about sort of the situation that Arendt was describing versus our situation today? What commonalities can we draw from Arendt's analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're so right to, in your reading of Origins of Totalitarianism, to not try and do this kind of crude transposition of conditions then and conditions now. Because when you read that book, I mean, as we discovered, Max, it's very idiosyncratic, right? In terms of the historical material it draws into the narrative. I mean, it's not a kind of structuralist or functionalist reading in any way. It really is attuned to the absolute particularity of that historical situation, and we must be attuned to the absolute particularity of our conjecture. And in that sense, there are some things nonetheless which do jump out at one as being lessons of origins of totalitarianism. And that is because these are not historically particular things so much as steadfast, as kind of, how would you say? I want to say something like universal, but modes of relationality between people, universal modes of relationality between people. And so the question of does lies or does some sort of factual truth become the basis upon which we understand each other, you know, and live in that common world, yeah, which one predominates? And at the moment we see that, you know, lies are absolutely ruling the roost. And in a funny way, I feel like this has been happening for decades, and I should have sounded alarm bells earlier, but I never did. Like, when you'd hear people say something, you know, dismiss the media and say, oh, you know, but, you know, the mass media and da-da-da-da-da, or, you know, the kind of Noam Chomsky thesis that the media is just about the manufacture of consent. Actually, now that we see, and to use in a very Arendtian phrase, you know, the chickens have come home to roost, our constant undermining of the media as simply a mechanism of the, you know, fabrication of untruths and the protection of vested interests, Trump uses that story today. And that story is so successful now because it's actually been lubricated for decades by the left. I would say actually it's a very simplistic understanding of the media. The media certainly does have capitalist financial imperatives. We know this better than anyone coming from Rupert Murdoch country. But the media also has, it's actually very heartening to see the media rally around this now. It has, you know, quite liberal principles of a commitment to truth, factual truths above all else. And at great personal cost to journalists. I mean, you still see journalists going into war zones and risking life and limb, or, you know, risking their careers in order to bring a certain story out. So that's the other part of the media. And that's something, I mean, I feel like I didn't defend enough in the past decades because, it was too easy to go along with this, yeah, well, the media just manufactures consent kind of story. What do you think about that?
Well, I think this brings up a really interesting point that that is really relevant for debating this anti-politics thesis, because the anti-politics thesis would say, it's basically this sort of reified realm of politics floats above society and is basically where the elite basically, you know, do things such as manufacture consent, come up with, basically have these sort of like intra-elite battles over certain ideas or culture wars or, debating what's different brands of the same neoliberal policy. Therefore, people have actually cottoned on finally, and maybe part of it is to do with sort of the end of mass media and the rise of social media, is that people are no longer take elite discourse on face value. So basically the answer can never be, all right, what we need to do is reestablish this sort of elite public sphere or political sphere. What we need to do is move forward in abolishing that political sphere as something separate to the social. So I think that, yeah, that kind of, I'm not sure if I'm 100% sympathetic to that position, but you are definitely 100% against that position, right?
Well, I mean, I'd question here your use of the word elite, because it operates in two senses. One is a sense in which I'm on side with you, and I'm, you know, very concerned, which is elite in a financial sense, which is backed by particular financial interests. And this runs against the truth imperatives of the media. Now, in that elite sense, I'm very worried. There's another sense in which elite sometimes gets bandied around, and it's an unfair use of the word, and that's in terms of an elevated and clarified medium of discourse. Some people are particularly skilled orators and particularly skilled analysts of the world. Yeah, that's a talent. Now, those people can be, we live in, not entirely, but certainly a partially meritocratic, we live in meritocratic societies. So those people can be drawn into these functions, such as journalism, in which they can do that best. Yeah. And so in that sense, I don't begrudge the elevated talent of people who might work at the New York Review of Books, or perhaps to cite something that is more commonly read, like the Washington Post or something, or one of these other, what Trump calls, failing newspapers.
But so you don't think that say, journalists represent a certain class of people? You'd be pretty hard to say, one, that they come from a diversity of class back and, sort of racial, et cetera, backgrounds. And two, that actually when they're working, that they don't belong to a certain political class.
To a political class?
Yeah.
Ah, so we're getting into the kind of intellectuals as a class kind of theories.
Well, not intellectuals, journalists, which I think I would hope you would agree are two very different things.
Well, some sociologists and social theorists do have lumped them in. Look, we could argue about this. We could get really bogged down in I think basically a restating of our positions. I would like to point out an analogy between the way in which you're starting to talk about the media and conspiracy theories. Is actually the magic elixir of our times right now, and it was also the magic potion which aided the rise of totalitarian power, because the conspiracy starts to undermine a common world again. Instead of seeing certain factual truths which provide a kind of backbone of this common world, we suspect that there are hidden motivations, hidden movements behind empirical reality. Yeah.
But I mean, there's things that aren't immediately available to us. That's why we need critique.
There's a difference now. When Hannah Arendt was looking at particularly the rise of Nazism, she identified that conspiracy became much more attractive to the masses who'd been thrown out of a common world, they'd thrown themselves out of a common world, than truth. And that was that conspiracy was incredibly coherent and consistent. So consistency and coherency become the hallmarks of a good conspiracy theorist, and we know this from talking to, our crazy mate at a party late on at 4 a.m. on Saturday morning. Everything is in. There's no detail which can't be accounted for. Now, factual.
But I thought that in her analysis of the totalitarianism and particularly some of those earlier movements like pan-Germanism and etc., one of the things that characterized it was precisely that they flip-flop all around the time, and so much more attention is to do with the sort of the charismatic leader saying that there's this sort of this all-encompassing theory that's going to explain it, but actually there's no particular internal logic to it.
No, you're absolutely right. This is a very interesting point, a very interesting detailed engagement with origins of totalitarianism. So conspiracy is very coherent and consistent, but you're right. Once totalitarian movements start to really gain momentum and become centered around the position and the communiques of their leader, There's absolutely no consistency anymore. In a way, the way you could describe this, and I'd have to think about it more to put it more eloquently, but is that conspiracy starts to prepare the ground for that sort of totalitarian intensification.
Right.
Because when you're in a situation which conspiracy theories start to circulate, so intensely, that common world has been threatened and undermined. When that has taken place, then you can actually have the advent of total inconsistency, which is where the Führer says one thing one day, says the opposite thing the next day, people feel no disorientation in switching from one to the other. I mean, this actually reached its peak in the Stalinist totalitarian experiment rather than the Nazi one, which didn't have as much time.
I want to return to sort of an analysis of sort of a more concrete political situation today. And I guess I'd want to get your thoughts on if a left populism is possible, is a good thing, or what it can achieve. And I'm sure you're going to say what the dangers are of it. And I want to look at Spain in particular, because I think that there's two particularly interesting things about Spain to look at. One is the success of Podemos as a sort of left populist project, which I don't think has any equivalent that I can think of. That's a highly successful new party built on a explicitly populist message. And coming from a left perspective. But the second interesting thing about Spain is that, unlike the rest of Europe, there's been no new far-right party emerge, no significant far-right movement. And I'm you can see where I'm going here. Is there a connection between the two? Has this populist mood being seized by Podemos? And I guess, what do you think about their rhetoric?
It's a great question. Certainly I'd have to say, first of all, we don't know how successful Podemos actually are right now, because they didn't do very as well as anticipated in this last election, and they've recently been backed by a very common occurrence in all in traditional parties, so they haven't escaped the party format, which is internal power struggles, and that's been played out. And in fact, Iglesias, is that how you, what's his name again? Pablo Iglesias, just kind of reasserted himself as the guiding intellectual and strategic light of the party. I mean, there's some alarm bells for me about the kind of centralization on this particular figure, but we'll leave that to the side. I think the more interesting question is what you just asked, is a left-wing populism plausible and desirable, given the Podemos example. Part of me wants to actually make a distinction clarify what we mean by populism. And this is very difficult, because in America and in Europe, populism means traditionally quite different things. You know, in America for a long time, it was actually associated with the left and with kind of rural needs and then an urban proletariat left. Nowadays, of course, it's associated precisely with the opposite, with the Tea Party and with movements. And in Europe, on the other hand, populism was always much more, because of the experience of the 20th century, treated much more as much more threatening. So is, when you say Podemos is populist, do you mean, you know, in it's kind of stylistic, or it's rhetorical, or is it substantively populist? Like, what do we mean by populist? In a way, I operate with a background definition of populism, which comes from who we were just talking about, Jan Werner Müller, and that is that populism is not about any particular rhetorical or stylistic strategies, but it is about an anti-pluralism. And in that sense, Podemos is not populist. It is not anti-plural. It is not identifying a true people who it's solely, you know, and that the true people is who it will speak to, and everyone else is kind of pushed out. I mean, if you want to see that sort of populism, you have to look at Turkey right now, or Hungary, or even Poland, where a kind of an authentic moral people has been identified within the empirical people, and so it enables some of, you know, some really gross abuses of constitutionality and of basic human rights. Now, Podemos is in that sense populist. They do follow the theorizations of Laclau and Mouffe, of course. Mm. In fact, Iglesias, you know, he's a classic for this sort of radical popular political thinker, actor. He's actually got an intellectual background. He is an intellectual. He comes from the universities, and he's read a lot of Laclau and Mouffe. And so for Laclau and Mouffe, just to briefly recap what their theory is, populism is absolutely an admirable and a desirable left-wing strategy, because what it does is it unites lots of particular grievances into what they call a chain of equivocation, something like this, so that kind of mass critical energy can be used against the status quo, against a kind of unjust existing political situation. And so they would say, you know, to give a concrete example, they would see how, you know, certain feminist struggles might be able to be linked into the Black Lives of women of colour, feminists linked into the Black Lives Matter movement. And this might be able, you might have queer allies coming into that as well. And you might have, you know what I mean? So you get this kind of expansive chain of significations, and these critical articulations against the status quo.
So there's sort of two modes of how you can define the people is what you're getting at, and one is that is in a very unitary people that sort of identified as with the nation and morality and things along these lines.
Yeah.
And then there's another mode of invoking the people, which is in a more pluralist or open mode. Is that right?
Max, you're an excellent interviewer. These are, and to condense it into two images of the people is a really great way to, show these two different ways of approaching the question.
Mm.
The problem becomes, in a way, and this is the problem confronting Laclau and Mouffe's turn to populism, can their people escape from some of the, you know, the kind of unifying, unitary and anti-plural tendencies of the other people? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And so there's always a question for me whether Podemos is actually as Laclauian and populist as it would like to think, because I think that once you actually get engaged in the field of political action and party politics, let's face it, they're no longer just a streets-based movement. They're engaging in the political machine itself. You actually have to start perhaps operating in a different, more complex way. So even though they might take some of the best parts of their adherence to Laclau's theory, so they might take the idea that there can be a lot of solidarity between actually quite diverse political movements, and they might take that kind of so they might take that, but whether they're actually they're certainly not anti-pluralist, so they're actually engaging in a way in within the liberal political machine in a more liberal way than they might self-understand, and that's not a bad thing.
But is the other part of populism precisely what you were sort of having a go at me for before, though, is identifying a political class and saying they're the enemy, or they're what's wrong, we need to overthrow the establishment, we need to overthrow the elite, we need to overthrow these sorts of the old guard who are not the people, and isn't that part of Podemos's rhetoric as well? But or do they do it in a different way?
Yep. And that's this can play out in two ways. So, yeah, populism is always, it always has to identify agents or a sector of the social that is not part of the people and that is, in fact, restricting the, you know, the happiness of the people. So this is the elites. I mean, in fact, all populist movements will pretty much call that sector the elites. Now, the irony is that most populist movements actually, I mean, we see with like Trump right now, they are the elites. You know, we know the irony of the drain the swamp Twitter hashtag because the swamp has never been so swampy.
yeah, but, so one thing, you know, it's sort of like his appointees for the cabinet positions are, you know, the richest appointees that there's ever been.
Yeah. In fact, he's introduced, whereas, you know, kind of a liberal politician like, and most politicians up until Trump have been, you know, operating within a liberal rubric, they would have kept, you know, the separation of powers was very, you know, sacrosanct to them. And even though we know constant cases of that not being followed, and certainly in American politics, you know, there's never been such a blatant attack on the separation of different powers. And I'm using the term now in a much more broad general sense to signify that financial interests are brought directly into government. So Podemos certainly does have, you know, that element of not just rhetoric, but, you know, it's also, it informs the content of their policies against, you know, against the elite. And in Spain, you definitely have a very entrenched post-dictatorship political class that's very conservative and very, you know, Spain is quite clientelist as well. So people benefit enormously from the right chains of connection. It's not conspiratorial or crazy to start pointing those things out and to, you know, work against them. Absolutely not. And I wouldn't even suggest it. But I would suggest that it's dangerous to fall into an us and them discourse because we know that contemporary societies are very much more complex. Yes.
So what sort of discourse should we use then? Are you advocating that instead of saying that you know that there's certain enemies of the people or certain people who plot against the people's interests, what we should instead be doing is, you know, is a critique of the social system rather than the ideology surrounding it or et cetera, rather than focusing on a certain set of agents?
Well, this is, I mean, because there are particularly pernicious agents in, you know, and by highlighting how a particular politician works, you might actually be explaining and showing a lot about, you know, how clientelism is actually pervading the political system or something. So it's not that I would always privilege like very abstract, you know, more structural interpretations over particularity. That's not it. It's the us and them discourse, which kind of simplifies the social field to such an extent that's actually the danger. And I mean, I'd say with Podemos, I don't actually follow the Spanish situation very closely, but I would say that there's tensions between both of those tendencies within them. You know, to bring back to the kind of meta point, this is the kind of danger of picking up populism as your political mode. That it's fraught with these dangers.
So just to return to a point that you made at the start, you said that Arendt doesn't say that her sort of prescription for action doesn't rest on a politics of empathy or understanding or anything of that sort. What does it rest on? What would she suggest?
A clear-sighted thought and action. While there is still a common world, and that's not always the case, you know, the common world can will was destroyed in the Nazi dictatorship and also in Soviet Russia. But while there still is a common world, one must keep it alive. And so that includes both action and deed in the public realm, and it includes judgment. And judgment doesn't have recourse to truth so much, you know, as an ultimate truth, as so much as it acknowledges the plurality of opinions and perspectives in that common world, and is committed to engaging with them while at the same time not being lost in them, but, you know, making some sort of judgment and taking up a particular position. So, yeah, rather than compassion and empathy, she would always say action and judgment are the way to go. But, Max, we've been talking for 36 minutes. I'm a bit tired.
That's enough. I think that was a good note to end on.
I could do that much better because I'm actually working on something on it right now, but I'm a bit, you know.
No, that was good. I think we covered some good issues. So thanks very much for listening. That was an interview with Allegra Rinalda about Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism, and we covered some other topics as well. Thanks very much, Allegra, for joining us again on Mazel Tov Cocktail. We hope to have Allegra back on as a regular guest. She's the show's token liberal, so we very much enjoy hearing her perspective and debating with her. Just a couple of shout-outs before we finish off the show. I just wanted to mention two podcasts which have been inspirations for this program, and that also have touched on some very similar themes, particularly around populism, anti-politics, and analysis of our current political situation. The first one is Novara Media, which... do fantastic work over the past few years, a podcast and media platform out of London. They had a recent video online, which you can check out on YouTube, of a live event that they had, which was precisely about the possibilities for a left populism. So I definitely recommend checking that out. And the second one is the Living the Dream podcast, out at some political analysis out of Brisbane, which is another excellent perspective on current politics, particularly interesting analysis from a political economy perspective from Comrade Dave Eden. So check those two podcasts out. And the last shout out would be to the Left Flank blog, which have been sort of at the forefront of developing this anti-politics thesis, which I referred to a couple of times in the interview. Certainly don't agree with everything that they put out there on the blog, but there's definitely some very interesting ideas and some excellent analysis to engage in there. And they had a very good series on Podemos a couple of years ago now, which I'm sure you can find through our old friend Google. So thanks very much for joining us, and... keep your eyes open for the next episode of Mazel Tov Cocktail. Thanks very much. Music in this episode came from the Eastern Watershed Klezmer Quartet.